everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. Tonight, I'm speaking to award-winning author Simon Wood, who has one of the most interesting lives of any of the authors that I've ever spoken to. And besides that, he's a really nice guy. Hang on just a few seconds here, and I can't wait to talk to Simon about his new book. Don't go away. Everyone, happy Tuesday night, I believe it is now. I don't know, I lose track of time. My guest tonight is Simon Wood. He is an award-winning author of thrillers and mysteries, and he's a lot of fun. I don't know how many of you have heard Simon on the show before, but he's had a really interesting life, and I love talking about that probably more than I like talking about his books, even though I love his books. Without further ado, I'm proud to welcome back Simon Wood. Hi, Simon. Welcome back to Authors on the Air.
Hey there. Thanks for having me back.
I love having you on the show. You're always so much fun, and you always tell the best stories. I haven't seen you now for a little over a year. I guess you're in BoucherCon, North Carolina, maybe, last time I saw you. And
yes.
You kindly brought me some yummy honey that you and Julie actually, on a note, do you raise honeybees? What do you say when you get honey?
We harvest it because it's
harvest.
We keep bees and we basically raid their supplies.
And you also sell locally to stores around you, correct?
Yeah, my wife's a genetic scientist, and at our old house we used to have a bottle brush tree that used to be full of bees every sort of spring, and then one year they didn't come back, and where we are in the Bay Area, we were starting to see the bee die-off and colony collapses and things, so my wife just wanted to start having bees just purely to repopulate the local area. But what we didn't realize is how much honey a beehive will produce in a year. So I think in our first year, of setting up from scratch, we ended up with about 25 pounds of honey, and it was like, this is too much. And now we have three hives which produce probably just under 300 pounds a year in honey. And each bee produces a teaspoon in its lifetime. To give you an idea of how many bees that is floating around. But, yeah, it was just purely a thing of, like, we have got way too much of this byproduct of keeping bees around. And so we just started our own little brand. And we supply a few stores. We do a bunch of direct sales and stuff. But mainly the weird thing was how many people who get it purely who've got allergies. So all our clients tend to be sniffly, sneezily people.
Yeah. It's a yummy honey, I have to say. And when I saw you, you had this tiny little jar, like maybe that ketchup or mustard would come in from a hotel room service or something. And you said, this is all I could bring because the airline won't let you take on anything larger, which I thought was just adorable. But it was so good. And I get, organic honey, unpasteurized and all from my local farmer's market, and I love it. It's great with everything. I want to ask you, before we get to talking about books and everything else, since you have the bees, have you noticed growth of flora and in your area too? Because obviously they're not just making honey. They're pollinating everything too, aren't they?
Yeah, we saw certainly our own. I mean, they travel, I think, 2-mile radius. Is what their go-to. Obviously, they'll hit local, But they go in about a 2 mile radius, and I think our garden at our first house and this house kind of, you saw a massive difference in from 1 year
really?
To the next, and in other people's houses and stuff. And we have like a apricot tree, and we got 500 pounds of apricots off one tree in the first year when we set up the bees. And we end up making our own jam and selling that because, like, 500 pounds. And we end up doing a thing on like, social media. If you want a bag of apricots, come to our house. And we still couldn't get rid of stuff quick enough. It was just so much. So,
amazing.
Yeah, it does make a difference.
That is amazing. One year, my nieces and nephews are all fine. You know, they're all grown and everything. And so at holidays, rather than sending them gifts, I buy things like, you know, honeybees for a developing country or something because we're at critical stages with the loss of honeybees. So it's a really important thing. Our entire ecosystem collapses without honeybees, doesn't it?
Pretty much, unless you're going to have to do pollination by us doing it manually, then pretty much nothing's gonna grow because around here is you have like little bee collectives basically set up their hives in orchards and groves and other things for commercial farming because they need something to pollinate and the beekeepers need something for the bees to make honey with, so you end up with these sorts of things. And my wife said if she lost her job or something, she would probably start doing some sort of expansion into, setting up backyard hives in other people's houses or doing some sort of commercial things with the various sort of like farms and stuff in the area.
I imagine your neighbors love you now because your bees are pollinating everything for them.
I think everybody gets a little worried that, you have 60,000 bees leave the house in the morning, then come back at night sort of thing. So it does look a bit weird when it literally is just, final approach at sort of like Bee Central. It looks a little, it's not all of them at once, but it literally, you will see thousands of bees just come back and return to the hive at night.
That
can be a little bit disturbing to people.
I guess so. Simon, you and I have spoken before, and I love listening to your stories because you've created such an interesting life for yourself. You started off designing water purification systems for oil rigs when they had leaky oil. Isn't that correct?
No, I did two things. One was I spent a number of years in – I did design sort of like oil safety barriers that kept all the noxious, nasty stuff ever leaking out into the atmosphere. But the other thing was I also designed water treatment plants for, basically municipal water, drinking water plants that would go in either, the UK, France, or something like that. That was my two different sides. But they were very similar sort of design approaches, but one was a little cleaner and safer than the other.
Did you study engineering in university?
I didn't go to university. I was something that was a rare breed now. I was a design apprentice. I basically got out of high school at 16 and then applied to companies, and they took me on as an apprentice, which meant I served like a 4 to 5 year period, which included me going to college, like an engineering school for a year, and then doing 4 or 5 years part-time after that. And then I worked for the company during that time, and I worked in all aspects of the company from, the stores to research and development. And then you kind of negotiate where you'll stay. And I went into this sort of like liquid systems thing in for oil rigs. But I just basically went, my first year of college was basically learning how to design things and all the production processes, and then doing the sort of hands-on thing. Then 6 months, it was like, here's an outline for something. You have to build it from scratch and make it work. And that was kind of, you know, you learn as you went.
Now,
I don't have any degrees.
Well, you know, you'd never know because you're just a really smart man. But you also told me that you had a fear of heights, so you decided to conquer that by learning how to fly an airplane, which just blows me away. I have a fear of heights, but I don't mind going on airplanes. I remember going, my brother used to have his law office on like the 65th floor of a high-rise building that overlooked the bay in Miami, and while it was a beautiful sight, the windows were sealing the floor, and I would get dizzy, and I could never walk up to the windows. I don't like flying, but I do it for convenience. If a horse could get me there with the same amount of time and where I wanted to go, I would ride horseback. But so you just said, okay, well, I'll go be a pilot. And so you did that, right?
Yeah.
And then after that, I didn't know you were a private investigator. You and Julie had a private investigation business. I mean, where did that idea come from?
We actually worked for an agency. We were basically just freelance for an agency. And what it came from, when I first moved to the U.S. in the 90s, I could not get work. It was probably one of the most depressing kind of things of like 18 months of, because when me and my wife sort of like made the decision who would come to America or who would go to Britain kind of thing, and it seemed easier at the time for me to make the jump. And then because I don't have a degree, my qualifications didn't mean anything over here. And because the school system's different, it would mean starting a four-year college degree from scratch. And I don't technically have a GED or a high school diploma because the education system is different. And so I was kind of like stuck. And so for, I think, 18 months I was unemployed. And I sort of begged them to get some, like, cashier jobs, and everybody said, well, you're overeducated for a cashier's job. And it's like, I'll take anything. And what we ended up doing was that it was mystery shopping at the beginning. It was, will you, you know, and because it was a real struggle to make ends meet at the time, it was sort of things like, it was like, oh, you can go to the supermarket and, you know, you got to make sure certain displays are on there, and that we've got this in there, and you get to keep whatever you buy up to, you know, an X dollar amount. So it's like, oh, we'll do that. And then we got a new movie theater opened, and we, the company that was looking after that for 1 year, we got to go to the movies once a week, and they paid
for
the movie tickets.
So you were fed and entertained.
And what we ended up doing was, I'm not joking, we ended up doing almost a barter system, where we were doing restaurants that went from, you know, Burger King all the way up to, you know, Michelin star restaurants, doing the same thing. We worked for, like, I think, two or three different agencies. And for other places, so if you like, all your discretionary income was being paid for by being mystery shoppers. And then it was sort of like, you know, we got bumped up and they said, would you like to do hotels? And we did hotels, and then one agency said, do you want to do casinos? It says, we need people to check the casinos are running properly. And we started with doing casinos in Vegas and the Indian casinos in California. And we would go in with, like, you know, for three, four days with a cover story and a budget kind of thing. And we would have maybe four or five assignments to do. Some would be, you know, this staff member's a problem, try to catch him doing the things that is complaints. Someone's stealing from the register in, you know, bar number four in this casino. So-and-so is offering illegal services. Try and get him to offer them to you. And it was all sorts of things like that. And that's when, you know, we had the PI license in Nevada, because you can't work without one. Whereas in California, we could work without a license because the agency held the license.
Interesting.
So it was an interesting thing, because it was a big people watching kind of thing, and you had to think on your feet, because, you know, normally they you'd have a script that you had to kind of work to, that you'd have to do it in order, that, you know, you'd have to do this A, B, C, D, but sometimes, you know, the situation doesn't play out to what the script was, so it would be sometimes improvising. And the worst things they used to do, they always send us to Vegas during the dark week, which is between Christmas and Thanksgiving, where the casinos basically, all their shows shut down as they
Christmas
gear up
New
for New Year's. No, this would be Thanksgiving to Christmas. It's usually dark.
Oh, Thanksgiving. Okay.
All the big shows.
Oh, I didn't realize,
you know, all
that.
The big shows basically go pack up. It's their vacation. It's the chance to, you know, make over the theaters, to do upgrades on the casinos. And going to Vegas during that time is like being in a ghost town.
Wow.
Nobody is there, because people are going to come back for New Year's, but no one is in that dead time between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And it's literally, you'll be on a casino floor with about maybe a dozen people, or in a restaurant, and you're the only one
there. I had no idea that it ever closed down. That's really amazing to me to learn that. So you're waiting for your immigration and naturalization service to do your application to stay in the country, which now, you know, it's crazy. It's crazier now than it was then, I'm sure. And you said, oh, I think I'll just be a writer, and out of nowhere. Or had you thought about being a writer?
No, because when I was back home, I kind of, the work that I did tended to be was contracts for, you know, either the rigs or the, you know, refineries or the people building them, or for the water treatment utilities. And so we were on a finite set of time. So it ended up being lots of hours. I used to work anything from a 60 to 80 hour week kind of thing, 7 days a week to get these out. So there was never really a thought for that. But it was like when I came to the US and I thought I'd slip into a job straight away, and I didn't. I suddenly had a lot of time on my hands. And I just kind of said, I don't really know why. I think I'd always daydreamed about stories in my head since I was little. But I kind of just went, I have nothing to do. I can't get anything. And I just started looking in on how to write stories. I'd never really done anything in school either. So I just kind of, you know, got some books on writing and sort of like worked out what the component parts of making a story were. And I kind of took an engineering approach to writing, and it just sort of went from there.
So there was a little wrinkle with your plan to become a best-selling author, though, right?
In what respect?
Being dyslexic. Well, it wasn't easy for you. Yeah.
No, I'm just, so yeah, so it was meant that my wife had to read those books out to me.
Because there were not
audiobooks. So I would understand
time,
the principles.
Right? There were not audiobooks at the time. You didn't have audiobooks at the time so that you could just listen to it, correct?
No, not for, like, technical books. Obviously for fiction and nonfiction, but for something like an audiobook on the art of writing didn't exist. So I would just sort of basically have her read them, then I would kind of, you know, understand the principle and go from there. And, you know, I just write and I don't really think about it. I don't worry about how shabby it looks, because it can always be fixed with, you know, when Julie and other people read through it and say, you know, this doesn't work. But in some ways, it's quite freeing because you never have to be conscious of what you do in that respect.
Now, do you handwrite or do you use your computer when you write? Because I think you told me that Julie actually she can understand your writing, your dyslexic writing, and so she does the corrections for you. So do you handwrite or do you use your laptop or your
computer? No, I use a computer. It would take me too long. I hate physically writing. I'm just too slow. And I can probably type faster than I can write. But then, you know, she reads through it and she marks it up. And, you know, we have sort of conversation. If it's too garbled, then, you know, she will say to me, now, what is it you're trying to say? And I say it out loud. And then she'll, like, go, well, that's what you need to write down because that's not what's on the screen. So it's just sort of like a little bit of a she's my C&I dog, I suppose, in that respect. She has to be the one who has to do it for me.
I hope she doesn't hear you say that.
Well, she's in Switzerland, so she's not here right now.
I'm emailing her the podcast. It's okay. She'll hear it eventually. and yet Julie has her own career, too. You guys are really quite a fine team, I have to say. Because it's not easy. She's a writer too, essentially, being your seeing eye lady.
Yeah, and she's a project manager for a biotech company, so that's her day job.
Wow, amazing! Let's talk about your new book. Let's talk about deceptive practices. I love this book. I truly do. From the beginning, from the first chapter, this book jumps up and grabs you by the throat and says, you are just not going to let go. That's it. You are in this book immediately. So what happens to Olivia Shaw? I'll let you go ahead and tell a little bit about the story because it's so much fun.
So her story is that she discovers that her husband is cheating on her. And that's how the story opens up, is that she's finally got visual confirmation of her husband cheating. So there's a moment of when she's going to just let caution to the wind and maybe do something stupid. But her sister, who's maybe a less than reputable and reliable character, says to her, no, come to me and I got something you might be interested in. So she sees her sister and she says, I want to introduce you to Infidelity Limited. And Infidelity Limited has an interesting pitch, which is, do you have a cheating spouse, a wayward child, a problematic business partner? If you've tried everything and now you just want to have someone knock some sense into them, hire Infidelity Limited. And essentially they do a kill or cure kind of intervention in a sort of scared straight kind of way, is that they will go and see the person you're having a problem with and basically through the medium of fists tell them either straighten up or go. And Olivia buys into it. She pays them the money. You know, she wants her pound of flesh. She's hurt, she's upset, and she wants her pound of flesh. And so she hires them, and she waits for the night that her husband's going to come home with a black eye. Instead, the police come to the house and tell her husband's dead and that he's been beaten up. Or he's been, you know, brutalized to the point that he's died. And then she gets the call from Roy at Infidelity Limited, who says, now I'm going to tell you what Infidelity Limited really does. And it's kind of a Ponzi scheme with a little bit of murder and extortion thrown in. And it's how Olivia basically tries to free herself of Infidelity Limited and tries to get the real people arrested for her husband's murder and try and make things right. But unfortunately, it's not as simple or as easy as that.
It is a fascinating book. It really is. It is truly one of the best character studies that I have read in a long time. Congratulations on such brilliant work. This is the end of a series of four books that you wrote that you call the Bay Area Quartet. Explain why.
Bay Area is somewhere that I relocated to basically in the, I think, like 2000. And when I really started to get somewhere with the writing, I didn't really know much about the Bay Area. And so, and like with all my books, I tend to explore where I live. And with this one, I decided to divide the Bay Area up into four sections. And with four books, I set four thrillers there. And it gave me a chance to explore the landscape and do something that was, you know, have a series but based on location rather than people and situation. So, you know, the first book was in San Francisco and surrounding area. The second book was in Marin County. The third was in Alameda and the South Bay. And then this last book, Deceptive Practices, is the East Bay, which is where I live, which... Yeah, there's a number of unusual meeting places that I used for that book because they'd be useful if you want to talk to people without being seen or things like that. So I used some unusual locations.
Simon, you have over 20 books now, don't you?
Probably getting close to, I think. I try not to think about it too much.
I think you do. I'm looking right now at your book list on your website. Let's see, 8, 12, 15, 20, plus Simon Janis, so 22. You are really, for someone who just thought, what the heck, I might as well write a book, you're pretty prolific and really very good. Your imagination has taken you great places. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's just an interesting thing. It's a journey you don't know. I think, you know, writing's kind of a little bit of a leap of faith. It might lead to something, it might lead to nothing. But if it leads to something, I kind of wanted to keep it going. So I think there'll always be more ideas than books that I'll ever write. So that'll always be the sad thing. I'll never get to write everything that I want to.
Now, you also write a lot of short stories. I think I read that you've got over 100 short stories and collections. Is that so?
Yeah, I've got about, I think there's 3-4 collections I've published. And there's certainly over 100 short stories, but yeah. I got a couple of more collections I've been sitting on for a little while, so I haven't had the time to get them published yet. So that's the only problem there.
When you write short stories, how many words do you generally write?
It really depends. I think earlier on in my writing thing, it used to be for whatever the magazine word limit used to be. So they may be anywhere from, you know, 1,500 words to 5,000 or so. But I've actually in recent years kind of got to like writing stories that are closer to 10,000 words each, because you can go into it. But I think the shortest short story I wrote was 2 words, but that was more of a joke story.
Is it more difficult to write a short story of you know, 10,000 words than it is to write a novel of 70 or 75, 80,000 words?
I don't think so, because I tend to just feel that I have an instinct of like, this idea is a book, this idea is not a book, and will work better as a short story. And I think if you think in those terms, it's somewhat easier to write because you don't have to be going like, well, I can just trim this novel down and it'll be a short story, because it doesn't really work
right.
like that. It's just one of those things when you kind of just know, it's like, you know, there isn't enough mileage in this story to make it into a novel, or it's the fact that this works more effectively as a short story to make the point or to grab the audience. This works better as a short story. If it was long, it just wouldn't work.
Yeah, I'm fascinated that authors can squeeze essentially a book into, you know, 1,500 words. I mean, to me, that's the sign of brilliance. That's a great writer who can do that. We have one show on the network that is, you know, does a lot of flash fiction, which is 700 to 1,000 words. I think if you can do kind of writing sprints of 1,000 words and you tell a whole story there, you know, bless you. That's talent, in my humble opinion. I want to take a moment here.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think it just comes down to, you can use little tricks. I've used tricks to, if you like, halve the word length and double the story by doing some little bits of, if you like, sleight of hand. And other things, I think some of my stories, you know, literally they are, if it ran in real time, they're only essentially maybe 10 minutes long in real time, because that's all it is. It may be just a chance meeting between people, or it happens in a single room. And then, you know, you cut down, you know, you're basically at the crux of the story. And also, a good short story, it may end on, you know, page 20, but the, if you like, the impact will keep going after that.
Yeah,
because the reader has to do a little bit more heavy lifting, that not everything's going to be, I won't say not answered, but there's going to be potential going forward with that story. And, you know, it's down to the reader, and every reader will see it slightly differently of what happens next.
I love that. I love the concept. I want to remind everyone that I'm talking to Simon Wood, who is an Anthony Award-winning author. He's got, I think it's 22 books out, including some collections, and 100 short stories. If you want to say hello, please feel free to call in. I'm going to give away a copy of his new book, Deceptive Practices. The number is 347-633-9609. 347-633-9609. Give a call and say hello to Simon. I know he knows everybody, so give us a call. I want to ask you, and then I had to rephrase this in a different way. Do you like to read? And if you like to read, do you have to do it through audiobooks?
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm not sure of the concept of, you know, I know reading is very difficult when one is dyslexic. So do you enjoy audiobooks, or is it a means to an end, or can you not be dyslexic? Can you learn not to be dyslexic and read? I don't know that much about it. So you'll have to enlighten me, and I'm sorry that I'm ignorant on the subject.
No, I do like audiobooks. I think it's because I grew up in the sort of 70s, and in the UK, I sort of pretty much lived with a radio on in the house. And, you know, we had Radio 1, which was more of a music station, but Radio 4 was kind of news, arts, and was like plays and book reading, you know, where someone would basically do the forerunner to the audiobook. They used to have things like book at bedtime, which would be someone would read a complete book in half an hour segments for as long as it took to read it. I would listen to that. And then I think back in like the mid-80s, audiobooks were kind of being produced, not in a big way, mainly for the library and mainly for people who were visually impaired. And
yeah.
I used to just get those And then there was kind of a little bit of an explosion in the late 80s where audiobooks really did start become a legitimate kind of format for books. And I just sort of would probably buy a couple a week, especially when I was working, and I would work Saturdays and Sundays by myself or something, or in an office with a limited amount, and I would have all these radio plays or these books, and then all the guys in the office would be listening to them as well. And so, yeah, it's something that I very much do love, audiobooks. I have, you know, I have a cell phone, but I probably use it mainly as a thing for navigation on the road and listening for audiobooks. And I've got like one room that's just filled with audiobooks. I've probably got about 400 or 500, and God knows how many on Audible now.
Wow!
But that's side of it, yeah. But the dyslexia thing is, you can't be cured. You just develop coping mechanisms. Yeah. Once you're, I think my sister actually is a child psychologist, and she's a university professor, and one of her things is, you know, pretty much once you pass the age of 12, if you've not been suitably helped in the, if you like, more formative years, by the age of 12, you're pretty much hardwired. And I did I've done the dyslexic test. There's an official name for it, but it's like 7 or 8 hours of testing. I've done that like 3 times over my life, and my result is exactly the same every time. Because I did it, I actually paid for it myself after my first book came out. I wanted to see if it made a difference, and it concluded no, it made no difference whatsoever.
And you've just adapted your life around that. And it makes sense to me, and so good on you. You have some really funny stories that you always – that I'd love for you to tell these stories. But you – we talk about you getting your pilot's license. I'm always so impressed because you did that here in the States also, especially because aren't you supposed to read technical manuals to learn how to fly a plane and to take the test and to get a pilot's license?
Yeah, I mean it's not as wordy as you would think. A lot of it is just you have to learn it, and it's got to be in your head. And planes are actually very cleverly thought out on inbuilt redundancies that if you lose electrical issues, then you can still make a plane fly. If you lose hydraulics, sort of thing. If you for your artificial horizon and all various bits, there's always a little something that will give you allow you to fly a plane safely, even if like virtually everything is crippled, all your systems. You can, as long as you've got literally just two things working, then you can pretty much save yourself, and doing a lot of mental calculation, you can still kind of navigate yourself out of trouble.
Amazing.
And so, you know, I mean, the nice thing is a lot of it is one-to-one. So if you're doing a lot of the flying, you're kind of learning hands-on with an instructor with nobody else there. So you can kind of tailor your learning to that. And then ground school is very much an interactive thing with a small group of people. So it wasn't too bad. And then you just know that, you know, you just need to understand a few sections of various things about the plane, that, you know, pretty much everything else is just is information, but it's the same thing from one plane to another. It's just drummed into you until it's in your head. I mean, I still can pretty much, you know, these things are kind of like built into you that you kind of remember. It's like,
but a cellular level.
Should be pulling, doing this, should be doing that. Yeah.
Right. Do you still fly, Simon?
I don't fly now, but I'm still current. I still have my FAA license and my CAA license. If I wanted to get into a plane, I'd probably be comfortable with someone co-pilot with me. But all I would have to do is just take my general flying test again. It wouldn't
very
be
good.
Too hard to sort of like just get back into it. But even if I was still everything was up to date, I'd still like to do my general flying test regularly. It's just a good sort of thing to keep you sort of like
keep you sharp, right?
Sharp,
because
you have to do stall flying and things like that.
Now, you also raced minis when you were still in the UK, correct? When you were still in England?
No, I raced open wheel back in the UK.
Open wheel. Okay. And I said, you know, they give you the directions of where you're going and all, and I ask you, you couldn't read the directions. How did you know where the track to follow? And you told me you put a map on the steering wheel.
Yeah, the very first race, I'd never raced at the place. The other thing with being dyslexic is I don't have great spatial awareness. I don't really know left from right. If I look, you know, north, look in a north direction on a street, I'll recognize it. If I go to the other end of the street, then turn and look at it from the opposite direction, that's a completely different street to me. It's not the same place. And I have to learn.
You're a woman.
So I kind of have to learn everything.
The way I am.
I have to learn every kind of place from every direction, and they may merge eventually, but usually not. So I have to learn a place or a thing from every conceivable angle, and then I'll kind of be able to find my way around. But my first race, I'd actually never stepped into the particular kind of car that I was driving. I was coming up a grade. I'd never driven it because of a couple of little issues, and they cut the map out of the program book and they stuck it on the dashboard and said, and they put all the, what gear I should be in for each part. And to be honest, that map was useful about 10 seconds because there's just way too much going on that to be looking at that and going, oh, okay, I should be in this gear for this bit. What I tend to do was I would just latch onto someone who'd been around the track before, and I followed them to get a feel for what I needed to do. And then once I kind of got it in my head, then you know, you develop your own lines and where you shift and where you brake are all sort of like very personalized after that.
How fun. Now, you also are a cyclist. Are you still doing that? I should say that's not motorcyclist. You have a bicycle, it's a very fine-looking picture of you in your bicycle gear. Do you race bicycles, or is this what you like to do for exercise, just for the fun of it? Because you did tell me a really great story that I'd love to share with you.
I do it for a little bit of health stuff, but I do compete in some time trial stuff, and I do like 60 and 100 mile rides. Some of them against the clock, and some of them are just sort of if like fun rides, as in like fun marathon things, but for bikes. But some of them are, you know, actually, you know, timed for the 100 miles or 60 miles. And some of them, you know, it's sort of like a little bit of a staggered release where you leave over a couple of hours and you'll need to be back by a deadline.
Have you taken up any new hobbies since I last spoke to you? I think a year ago.
No, I don't think so. I think we've just been doing a lot of animal fostering in the last year or so. So we've that kept us busy last year because we had like 10 different animals in our house plus our usual crew that we had.
The menagerie.
Yeah.
And in between all of these wonderful things, you write fantastic books. My favorite story that you tell, I don't know if you remember that I ask you this every single time you're on my show, but I love this story of the bike accident at the intersection. Will you please tell listeners that story?
I think it's one of those things that certainly coming from a country where it is law of the land, and it goes from top to bottom. The problem with the US is everything's fragmented and broken down into various little fiefdoms, and that creates issues. And I was riding to work when I had a real day job, and a woman turned right in front of me when I wanted to go straight ahead at the intersection, and she wanted to make the right turn. So I went over the car and over the handlebars of the bike, and I picked up a pretty bad concussion, some internal bleeding, and some things like that. And the problem was it was on a city-county line, and there was three different agencies fighting over who shouldn't respond. So there was the city, the county sheriffs, and CHP, and it was all a little bit of a dogfight over who didn't want to take the call. So I ended up standing there for about half an hour waiting for somebody to come out and respond to the accident. In the end, I just a work friend saw me, pulled over, I got in the back of their car, and they took me to hospital while the lady still waited for someone to come out. But yeah, it's one of those things. But the conversations were interesting because there's a couple of bystanders, and one of them had the police department, one of them had the county sheriffs, and so they were like saying, which direction was he coming from? Because it'll be their problem. And someone was saying, which way did he land? Because if he landed in this side of the line, then it's their problem. And so it was just an interesting conversation.
Good grief, good grief. You know,
which way was he pointing?
God, you poor guy. Concussion and some internal bleeding, and they're arguing over who doesn't want to write up the report. It's just...
Yeah,
it's
I actually got hunted down by CHP. Ended up being CHP's problem, and they hunted me down, and I was made to come to the police station after I'd been discharged from hospital, and said, you know, because they were angry that I'd left the scene of the accident. And I was like going, well, I said, it took you 40 minutes to answer the phone because we were having 911 problems in this particular part of the country. And I just remember standing there and this guy just berating me, and I was just sort of like very dazed and just like going, that's fine, I'll go now. But I, you know,
oh
I left
God.
All my details, but they were just upset, and I just thought it was very ridiculous. Cause I thought, what if I had been unconscious and there was an ambulance? Would they have expected me to hang around?
Exactly.
So I'm not
sure what the
riot act was for, but.
You know, you could have had, like, in Florida, we have the city, the county, the state, then you have whichever road it's on, if it's privately run, whether it's a toll road, that's another thing. Whether it's highway patrol, that's another thing. So thank God it happened out in California and not here in Florida. Because you might still be lying in the road, Simon, I have to tell you.
But that's one of my little things. I know everybody sort of says, you know, let's have small government. And one of the big things I would do is completely restructure the police department that, you know, you don't need 100 different police forces. It's like, I would at least, let's break it down and have one police department for each state. That would cut down bureaucracy and some of the arguments.
That just makes too much sense. That makes way too much sense. Are you finishing another book? Have you started writing? Is this going to be a racing book? Is this going to be out of your racing series? Or
I've actually written one of the racing books, but I've just not had time to do the final edit. And because it's set at Christmas time, I don't want to. It's not a Christmas story, but it's set during Christmas in the off season. I want to bring it out on Christmas Day, so that will probably come out Christmas Day this year. But that has been sitting down and finished for about 18 months. But I just need my final final readers to give their run over that. But this is actually the book I'm working on right now is the follow up to Paying the Piper, which I want to turn into a trilogy now. It's not that the Piper story comes back, but it's more of it's going to be three stories about the two main protagonists. And that will be my red, green, blue trilogy for them. The color plays into the stories.
Right,
into the book.
Right. Fascinating. Simon, tell everyone where they can find you, because you, and I want you specifically to mention your website and your newsletter, because if you've never read one of Simon's books and you sign up his newsletter, and by the way, if you sign up for his newsletter, don't unsign, you will get a free book. But please don't do that to an author. Sign up just to get a book and then unsubscribe. It's really rotten. Where are you on the web?
My website is simonwood.net. That has links to my Facebook and Twitter pages, and if you want to sign up for the newsletter, that's on the front page of the website, on the right-hand side.
Absolutely. Simon Wood, it is always a pleasure talking to you. I always learn something new and interesting from you. I hope you'll come back again, and because I don't know when I'm going to see you. I'm probably not going to be at BoucherCon in Toronto. Will you be going, or are you spending your
I'm on
the
fence
coast?
Right now. Is that my wife and I are looking at a vacation. If we do, it's probably going to clash now with BoucherCon.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of playing it by ear.
Very good. Well, got to take time off. You know, you've been writing all these great books. And she's been working out of town, so it'd be nice to take a vacation. Any ideas what you're going to do?
Ideally, I'd like to go to Australia and do a little bit of traveling around there, because I've still not been there. And I do have family there, but I just want to go for just us, sort of like do a little bit of traveling and sort of see the country.
Well, I hope that you get to go on your vacation, and I'm very grateful for you taking so much time. I know I told you 30 to 45 minutes, and it's almost been an hour. Thank you so much for being with me, Simon. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and come back whenever you want, please.
Great. Thanks very much.
You're absolutely welcome. Good night, Simon.
See you later.
And tomorrow night, I'm going to be talking to David Swinson. Boy, has he got a great story, and is he a magnificent writer. Thanks for being with me, everyone. Have a really great night, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.